It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. That is music from Baldur's Gate 3 as the video game industry comes together to hand out dozens of awards. We discuss the winners, the trailer drops, how Wisconsin is preparing future video game developers. And you can call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Seth Barrier is a professor and director of the computer science program at UW-Stout with a research focus in graphics and game design. Seth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with Baldur's Gate 3, Game Awards top pick for 2023's Game of the Year. Role-playing adventure set in the Dungeons & Dragons universe. Do you agree with this Game of the Year?
You know, I think I have to. The support behind it is unstoppable. And it really is, you know, it has a pedigree in video games. Baldur's Gate was one of the first really genuine translations of Dungeons and Dragons into the video game world. And I think the crossover there with Dungeons and Dragons having a sort of resurgence right now, they had a tailor-made audience for this game and they did it so well. It really is a top-notch production values throughout the game, a really compelling story. They just checked off all the boxes. It's hard to argue with it.
What makes a video game of the year? What makes it rise to the top?
Well, I think it needs to have a certain quality and polish to it. That always has to be there. But I think it's pretty recognized in the industry that this is also a popularity contest. I mean, the Game Awards lets the internet vote to some extent. We don't know exactly how those votes influence the main awards versus the juried part of it. But it is a bit of a popularity contest for that. And all the big names that were nominated for that were all ones that had really good sales, where everybody that was playing, they really cut across markets. But it's really, I feel like all the nominees all really had good stories to tell this year too. You know, you could sink your teeth into it. You could really get into the characters and feel their world. Even something like The Legend of Zelda: Tears of the Kingdom. A lot of people have felt that the story that was in that surpassed its predecessor, Breath of the Wild. It was really compelling. We got to see a side of Zelda and sort of her involvement in the game that we hadn't seen before. So storytelling, I think, this year was something that set games apart.
And you know, for instance, in Baldur's Gate 3, I haven't played it, but I understand how characters may face racism and they might face hatred. And I'm wondering, as you talk about stories, how do real world issues affect like medieval fantasy and that type of world in storylines and plots?
Well, I see a lot of writers can find a vehicle in these sort of structures that have been there in high fantasy. You know, Baldur's Gate is certainly high fantasy. Mm-hmm. But it's a world that's full of all sorts of different races and creatures. And you can kind of create your own character however you want to. That classic D&D character creation kind of moment that you can embody. And I think, you know, a lot of games really like to lean into that these days. They will let you be that muscular male hero if you want to be, but they will let you also be just about anything else you might like to. And they don't shy away from how the world might treat that character. And you know, it comes up in Baldur's Gate. It comes up in a lot of narrative stories these days. I think because as the gaming audience grows, they want to speak to more of those people and tell them, hey, you're welcome here. We all just want to play games and have fun. And I think they're striking a balance between, you know, not sending, you know, all the people that have enjoyed the narrative as it was up to now running. They still want them to be welcome at the table, but welcoming everybody else as well. And I think you can't shy away from those controversies to do that, and they haven't.
Exposing you a bit here, you found a favorite in Legend of Zelda: Tears of the Kingdom, won the category for Best Action Adventure. What makes the latest Zelda a quality adventure game?
Oh, it's I mean, I think the experience in general is still a role-playing game. It always winds up in the action adventure category, but you really get immersed in that world. You're just allowed to go anywhere. It's the Zelda open world adventure, really perfectly executed. And I think in terms of casual gameplay, Tears of the Kingdom is probably the better of the two. And we've got Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom that are both made in the same engine, that same kind of ilk. Essentially, it's a sequel to it. But they added so much. They just let you play with everything in the world, stick things together. You can create whatever you want. It has a little bit of that craftiness to it, but at a level that no other game has delivered to us before. And that's going up against things like Minecraft, which do a wonderful job of letting you play. I think Tears of the Kingdom found a better way to do it. That might be a spicy take, but it's just, I found that I could really just sink my teeth in the way I interacted with the world that other games have not achieved before.
Okay, so your two cents before we move on. Is this it? Is there a sequel? Will fans get
Oh, I think I mean, of course, it's the Zelda franchise. It will keep coming to us. But I bet they're going to move on to something different at this point. I mean, we've got the Switch 2 right around the corner. Who knows when that's happening? Nintendo hasn't said anything, but they need a big game to promote that. I'm sure they're working on it.
Seth Barrier with us, director of the computer science program at UW Stout, as we talk about this year's video game awards. You can join in. Questions and comments are welcome at 800-642-1234. Seth, stepping back to look at the industry, Microsoft moving forward with its buyout of developer Activision Blizzard, and the deal faces federal antitrust pushback. Microsoft makes the Xbox console series, and Activision's most popular games are the Call of Duty franchise. How is the merger between gaming giants affecting the industry?
Well, I think so. This year we had the Midwest Game Developers Conference in Madison, which is a really great place for the industry to get together right here in Wisconsin. And one of the keynote speakers at that, Ben Cavallo, talked about how the middle in terms of game production, we've got AAA at the top, we've got indie developers at the bottom. What's in the middle? Your sort of AA, single-A developers, they're kind of disappearing. It isn't there anymore. The business model that supports that and manages to find the budget that's in that range, it just doesn't exist anymore. And I think these mergers are pushing that even further. Companies keep scooping up other companies into their fold, and the big gets bigger. And oddly enough, I think indies are getting smaller. And this is, partially due to not smaller in numbers, but smaller in their team size. And I think that's partially due to the tools getting better. Game engines can really empower you to make something without needing quite as many people as you have in the past. We have some of these great examples of solo games that have been made, Stardew Valley, and the Toby Fox's games, and where really just one person can make it, and the tools I think are what make that possible. And it's weird, it just leaves this gap in the middle. There's opportunity there, I think, because there's no reason that that can't exist. But right now, the more these companies merge, the more lonely it gets in the middle.
And we've read reports of thousands of employees laid off in the industry. Is there a connection there? What do you see happening to the industry itself and supporting jobs?
It's hard to say exactly what is leading to these layoffs. There's some really big examples where we can point to genuine mismanagement. Unity is one of the big game engine companies, and they really made some mistakes this year in changing their pricing model. The entire industry kind of pushed back against them and said, "What are you doing?" They were going to start charging per install. Every time someone installed your game, you were going to have to pay Unity. And they lost a lot of business. It resulted in a lot of layoffs. They were, according to videogamelayoffs.com, they were the number one in terms of number of employees that got laid off this year as a result of really what people see as this mismanagement. Their CEO, John Riticello, had to end up resigning. And then the other big game engine is Unreal Engine. It's what powers Fortnite, and is run by Epic Games. A lot of people started pushing on Unreal, but then mid-year, Unreal had a series of layoffs where Tim Sweeney, the CEO, sort of took responsibility for mismanaging, overspending and beyond what he could, which really shocked me. It was like they must be rolling in money with something like Fortnite propelling them, and yet it seemed to lead to, I think, 800 employees got laid off as a result of that. So at least on the bigger side, as companies get bigger, I think they're having growing pains. They are maybe making riskier decisions, and the people that really pay for that are the game devs themselves.
Do you find that your students are nervous for the industry, or are they eager to join it?
When Unity was having their sort of self-inflicted wounds with their pay model, boy, the students were talking to us every day about, oh, what does this mean? Should I bother learning the Unity engine? Is this a skill moving forward, or are they going to die? And we kept saying, they're not going to die. They're big enough. They will survive this. They are still here. They've made a lot of amends. But yeah, I do get the sense that there's nervousness among them. I think that nervousness is really palpable on the art side as well. Because artists are seeing generative AI do kind of what they're training to do. We've tried to approach that from the standpoint of, hey, this is a tool. Put it in your toolkit. Learn how to use it well, and you could be a part of that. But then, yes, there is a lot of nervousness about the industry.
UW Stout computer science professor Seth Barrier provides analysis on the Game Awards, what it takes to train the next generation of video game programmers and developers. Be part of the conversation. Call in with the question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. There's more conversation ahead on the world of video games. You're listening to Music from Zelda. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, we're listening to Game Sound from Super Mario Brothers Wonder as we touch down in the world of video games, exploring the accolades presented by the Game Awards and developers who are moving the industry forward. We have UW Stout computer science professor Seth Barrier, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Seth, let's talk about the sequels and the remakes. One finalist for Game of the Year is a remake of the 2005 zombie game Resident Evil 4. Other nominees were either sequels or parts of franchises. Why are remakes and sequels common in gaming?
Well, I think you can look at Hollywood also and how many sequels they're making. There's a market. There's nostalgia that they can tap into. What's interesting, I think, for video games, often, when movies are making sequels, they're doing just that. But video games will just take an old game and just completely remake it. It is the original game, but with modern technology, modern graphics. Maybe they update the control scheme a little bit. Resident Evil 4 is a great example of that. It was really held up this year as one of the most faithful recreations, where it still felt like the original game, but it had all the lessons that have been learned since 2005, baked into it, so that it was more accessible to play and really helped people to, enjoy the original, but not feel like it was too old. That's an interesting balance that they have to strike when they remake a game. And there's some examples where they don't do enough. But I think they tap into nostalgia. People like me are, in our 40s now, but we grew up playing, Nintendo games for years, or we were Sony and Sega fanboys, and now they can remake these games. And the market's there. Plus, we finally have some income. I always told my parents, I'm going to buy the games I want when I grow up. Well, I do that now. I really do. So, I think that leads to a lot of these games existing again and hopefully being enjoyed by a whole new generation in the process.
How do you navigate that creative element with students, like designing video game material that's inspired by previous games or franchises?
I think we always say to them, and what we're doing, that you cannot use a pre-existing franchise, otherwise we'd get nothing but Pokemon knockoffs from our students. And so we do tell them, that you have to be original and creative, and they have an opportunity to do that in college that they probably not going to have in the industry once they get out in there. But I mean, all art is inspired by prior art in some form. It's rare that a truly new creation gets made. They're always talking when we pitch a game to us that this is Zelda meets Pokemon, but set in a high fantasy world or something like that. I think it's just part of the creative process. Interestingly enough, we see that being distilled down into AI tools now, because that's all they're doing is remixing what's happened before. So it's very, I think, it's something that we encourage them to do, to think about it that way, and to not reinvent the wheel. If it was done well before, they might as well learn how to make it new enough that people recognize it as something innovative, but not unfamiliar. That it's still a comfortable place that they would like to embody for, 20 to 40 hours, which would be the typical sort of AAA gameplay.
Are you using AI tools in your curriculum so students have a handle on how they can be used in the game development process?
It varies. It's been sort of a seismic event in upper education, AI tools, and we're starting to learn how we integrate them into at least our upper level classes, where we feel the students are mature enough to use them appropriately. I've been integrating them into a lot of my courses, where we are doing just pure programming, and I want them to learn how to have that sort of AI assistant that is there, and it really turns into a very insightful autocomplete, but still, all the time it's hallucinating things that don't really exist. And so you've got to learn how to use that. And when at Stout, we talk a lot to people that are in the industry, and we ask them, are you using AI? And universally they say, yes, we are, as long as there's no liability involved. At the end of the day, if you're an insurance company, you can't use that, because somebody has to, stand behind what you've created. On the art side, it is a trickier endeavor. I think learning to, as they say, prompt engineer, so learn how to write something that you would put into ChatGPT that gets you the result you want. That is a very different kind of curriculum from what they would traditionally teach. And our School of Art and Design is really invested in foundational skills. Everybody has to learn how to paint and to draw, life drawing, and to go through sculpture before they're given the digital tools and taught how to use those. So we're navigating it. Some classes use them. It's entirely up to the professor, what they choose. And others are just, make a clear statement at the beginning. No, you need to learn how to do this yourself before you let the computer do it.
Seth Barrier, director of the computer science program at UW-Stout, as we explore the year in video games and the highlights awards. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Seth, you mentioned earlier that there's this kind of blurry line in the indie world, and this year's Game Awards included controversy over the indie game category for its nomination of Dave the Diver, and players control Dave and other characters as they collect fish and get in adventures while running a sushi business. What makes something an indie game?
It's almost as difficult to identify these days as it is to what makes something an indie movie, right? In terms of that specific category at the Game Awards, it is up to the nominating committee. They are given very little guidance. They're just say, who would you nominate for an indie game? And they can interpret that the way they will. And so when the nominees came out, people saw that Dave the Diver was nominated there, but it's backed by a company called Nexon, which is a huge company. And while the development team might have been smaller, the game itself had plenty of resources to lean on while it was making it. And it doesn't feel quite like the spirit of indie. So I think ultimately, the sort of organizer of the Game Awards, Jeff Keighley, held over the fire and asked, what are you doing here? You can't treat indie games like this, at least other indie companies felt that way. And he ultimately stood his ground, and he said, you know, that the people that make these games can ultimately determine what indie is, and that he would welcome any game, even something like Tears of the Kingdom, as a as an indie game. So I think he's leaning into that controversy, and ultimately I think I have no qualms with Dave the Diver getting more attention. It's a delightful game. Its art style, I think, really does sort of push against the super polished games that we see coming out of AAA companies. And that's also part of the indie spirit, you know, this idea that we can have pixel art, we can have games that deliberately look retro, and they're still right up there with other games that have, you know, billion-dollar budgets, and ultimately can you know lean into photorealism and scan actors into the world. It's all welcome. That I think is the real the silver lining to all of that controversy.
Well, pixel art brings us to your program, Stout, being one of the top game design schools in the nation, as we've learned. What makes Stout, UW Stout, stand out in this area?
Oh, I will. I came here just because I, you know, could nurture my passion as a computer scientist while teaching people to make games. I thought that was delightful. And we do it by bringing artists and computer scientists together. I think a lot of schools strive to do that. Even other schools in Wisconsin do have game design programs, but we're the only one that has 50% artists, 50% programmers in the classroom working together to make a game, and learning how to deal with the needs of each side, and how they can push and pull on each other. I think that's a vital skill for anyone that wants to go into a design discipline. I always say to students when they're coming in, this is really just a good software engineering degree that you're getting when you do game design under computer science, because you're learning to talk to people that don't necessarily know how you do what you do. You know, the artists maybe keep the program at an arm's length sometime, and the computer scientists, they don't know how to model these amazing artifacts and to build the worlds out in tools like Maya and Blender, but they still have to work together to make something, and that is a case I think with a lot of projects nowadays, not just games, where there's diverse stakeholders at the table, learning to hear everyone's voice, to trust their judgment, and also, you know, learn when you should push for the things you want in there. That's something we develop, and I think it's pretty unique to Stout.
So, what games are you excited for in 2024? What are you looking ahead toward?
There's so much that's in my mind, you know, and I think a lot of them, unfortunately, are probably not coming out till 2025, and I have to think about what's really coming out in 2024 here. But I'm super excited to just hear more about what Hideo Kojima is working on. I finished Death Stranding recently, absolutely enjoyed that experience, and he talked about his new project, which is mysteriously called OD, and we know nothing about that. That was one of the premieres at the Game Awards, but he didn't talk about Death Stranding 2, and we know he's making it. So I'm just excited to hear more about that, because I thoroughly enjoy being a part of it. One of the other really surprising announcements for me at the Game Awards was Visions of Mana. And so there was this beautiful trailer that started out, and I immediately recognized the music in the background, which is this beautiful modern orchestration of something that I had listened to in a 16-bit world when I was like 13,
It brought
on
you
the Super
back.
Nintendo. It did. And I was like, oh my gosh, I recognize that. Then the original game was Secret of Mana, which I was one of my favorites when I was growing up. And so to see them making a new game set in that world, it isn't just a remake. I'm really excited for that. And that one is coming out in 2024.
Seth, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Seth Barrier, professor and director of the computer science program at UW Stout. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is more music from Baldur's Gate 3 here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.